Today, Pop goes independent central bankers. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one that is post covering finance and property news. Central banks have, it's claimed, played an integral role in the evolution of modern economics. Initially, central banks were closely tied to governments. Their independence became a formalized goal in the late 20th century, especially post the 1970s inflation crisis. However, critics argue this independence is often more theoretical than practical. And actually, the global trend towards independence, while not without critics, is often cited as a cornerstone of macroeconomic stability for the last four decades. I have my doubts about that, given that they're run by technocrats with a neoliberal bias and economic assumptions to boot. With a blind spot relating to the private debt in particular, and how that is multiplied with the banking system. And so I believe, in fact, they are part of the problem, which has created widening poverty gaps across and within countries. They are actually not part of the solution. Within that neoliberal framework, empirical studies have repeatedly shown a robust negative correlation between measured central bank independence and inflation, particularly in cross-country comparisons from the 1980s to the 2000s. Advanced and middle-income countries that move towards independent central banks systematically, they say, enjoy lower and more stable inflation with limited negative impact on real output or employment volatility. But again, this is through a rather narrow lens. Political dynamics are cyclical, of course, and in the current era of heightened populism, fiscal stress, and complex policy demands, effective and impartial monetary governance can't be assumed. Indeed, the role and purpose of central banks is currently in the crosshairs. Given they are charged with overseeing national monetary policy, issuing currency, and increasingly maintaining the stability of financial systems, they are truly just another arm of government, and work in close conjunction with the national treasuries to facilitate government funding. So absolute independence is, well, truly a bit of a myth. Now, a bit of history is helpful here, I think. The foundation of central banks can be traced back to the 17th century, with Sweden's Riksbank in 1668 recognized as the world's first central bank. Initially, its purpose was pragmatic, responding to the collapse of Stockholm's Banco, which had failed due to unchecked note issuance under royal influence, thereby underscoring the risks of politicization and prompting parliamentary oversight of the newly established institution. Not long after that, the Bank of England was established in 1694 as a joint stock company designed to finance government debt and to facilitate commerce. Over the subsequent century, the model spread through Europe with the establishment of the Banque de France in 1800, itself a response to the monetary chaos of the French Revolution and government financing needs. So early central banks were not state-centric technocratic entities. They generally operated with private or mixed ownership, managed state debts, issued currency, and gradually evolved into lenders of last resort, particularly as financial systems matured. The US experience underscored the fraught relationship between politics and central banks. The first, the 1791 and 1811, and second, 1816 to 1836 banks of the United States, were contentious and ultimately short-lived, criticized for excessive concentration of financial power and for serving elite interests over the majority. Following the dissolution of the second bank, the US ended a prolonged era of banking instability and recurring financial panics, culminating in the Panic of 1907. This crisis precipitated the creation of the Federal Reserve System in 1913, an institution deliberately designed to balance public and private, central and regional interests, reflecting persistent tensions between democratic control and technocratic management. Beginning in the late 1990s, central banks responded to calls for greater openness with the adoption of Transparency and Accountability frameworks. The IMF developed the Central Bank Transparency Code, the CBT, which became a recognized international benchmark. The CBT evaluates five pillars: governance structures and mandates, policy frameworks and objectives, policy operation and tools, monitoring and outcome reporting, and official relations with government, financial sector, and the public. Now, it's interesting to note that recent reviews of the operation of the Bank of England, the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, and the Reserve Bank of Australia all highlighted significant areas requiring improvement, especially around communication, modelling effectiveness, and overall transparency. In fact, transparency supports independence by clarifying the intent behind policy moves, facilitating the public's ability to hold technocrats accountable without direct interference, and demonstrating that central banks are not states within state, but delegates with specific limited mandates. In Australia, the mandate is agreed with the Treasurer, and the RBA turns up to be questioned by the House Economics Committee and Senate estimates. But frankly, they are more staged events with little real teeth, and frankly, too, questions are often dodged. Their ability to manage inflation is also in question, with recent responses to rising inflation dubbed as transitory. Then they drove rates up, and then letting them down, maybe slowly, maybe fast, who knows, with many unintended consequences. New Zealand is a good example, where the Reserve Bank of New Zealand responded quite smartly to the post-COVID inflation risk, but as a result created a recession, and now they are cutting rates to try to control the economic damage that they created. And of course, home prices in New Zealand are falling. The Bank of England cut rates again recently, despite inflation being well above their target, while the Federal Reserve recently changed its policy on targeting and is wrestling with sticky inflation and now political pressure to cut rates. Without explicit parliamentary mandates, the bank's recent forays into distributive or environmental policy have also drawn political challenges, threatening backlash and potential reform of its independence. While the ECB is often hailed as a paragon of statutory independence, the post-2008 euro crisis exposed its vulnerabilities. The ECB assumed new roles, including crisis management, macroprudential supervision, and support for climate policies, often at the behest of dominant national actors, or to fill a leadership vacuum in the EU. This activism led to lawsuits over programmes like the Outright Monetary Transaction, OMT, PEPP, and the Transmission Protection Instrument, the TPI. Widespread debate about democratic deficits and appropriate oversight followed, and there's increasing calls for increased transparency and counterbalancing institutions, for example, stronger European parliamentary roles. The Federal Reserve has also faced periodic presidential interference. President Nixon's arm twisting of Fed Chair Arthur Burns in the early 1970s is widely seen as a key cause of the decade's inflation explosion. In the 21st century, high-profile political pressure returns, of course, with President Trump, and now, more recently, within Congress, seeking to sway or threaten independent monetary policy to achieve short-term political benefits, particularly ahead of elections. Which brings us to what US President Donald Trump is currently doing. By threatening to fire Chair Jerome Powell, actively seeking to sack Governor Lisa Cook, and attempting to fill the Board of Governors with appointments sympathetic to his calls for low interest rates, he's shattering the Fed's veneer, or mirage, of operational independence. Now, here are five case studies to consider, which suggests that the naked politicization of monetary policy can, to put it mildly, deliver suboptimal results. Loss of credibility, currency weakness, spiking inflation, rising debt, elevated risk premia, and potentially much higher borrowing costs. In Turkey, Erdoğanomics, the unorthodox economic theories and policies of Erdogan, who has been president of Turkey since 2014, are a prime example of politicized monetary policy. Erdogan, an avowed enemy of interest rates, is on record as saying high interest rates cause inflation and that the way to reduce inflation is therefore to lower borrowing costs. He fired or replaced five central bank governors between 2019 and 2024, some for hiking interest rates or refusing to cut them. With inflation interest rates hovering around 20% in late 2021, the central bank succumbed to those pressures and slashed borrowing costs. The result? The currency collapsed and inflation soared above 85%. Few central banks in the modern era have so clearly been de facto arms of government as Argentina's Banco Central de la República Argentina. Successive governments have leaned heavily on the BCRA to print money to fund their spending with predictable results. The country has been in and out of economic crises and battled high and even hyperinflation for decades. The tenure of a BCRA president seems to be short. There have been 13 BCRA heads this century, and there were seven in the first 7 years of Carlos Menem's presidency between 1989 and 1996. President Cristina Fernandez de Kirchner also notoriously fired BCRA chief Martin Redero in 2010 because he opposed her plan to use $6.6 billion in foreign exchange reserves to pay down debt. Pressure on the Reserve Bank of India has intensified under the government of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. In December 2018, the RBI governor then resigned abruptly after just 2 years in the job, following months of government pressure to ease lending conditions and allow the government more access to reserves to boost spending ahead of national elections. In the months before the governor departed, Modi also removed RBI board members and appointed his supporters in their place, unnerving investors. This helped push the rupee to a then record low against the dollar at October, and annual inflation more than trebled over the following year to nearly 8%. In Japan, the situation is a little bit different, given that Japanese leaders have often been actively seeking a weaker currency and higher inflation, but the cozy relationship between the government and the Bank of Japan has still arguably had a negative impact on the country's long-term economic health. Japanese government and central banks have worked almost as one while competing several foreign exchange interventions over the years. The ties deepened with the rollout of Abenomics in 2012, the economic reforms under Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. That included the three arrows of fiscal policy, monetary policy, and structural reform. At the heart of Abenomics was unprecedentedly loose monetary policy, even by Bank of Japan standards. The central bank expanded its balance sheet massively. It's still around six times larger than the Fed's as a share of GDP, and deployed negative interest rates for years. Well, did it work? Many critics argue not, as growth remained sluggish, inequality rose, and Japan is now hamstrung by the world's largest public debt load. Which brings us back to the US. As discussed in the early 1970s, President Richard Nixon pressurized the then Fed chair, Arthur Burns, to keep monetary policy loose ahead of the 1972 election, even though inflationary pressures were building. Nixon also reportedly told Burns in 1969, just after he nominated him, that previous Fed chair Bill Martin was always 6 months too late doing anything. "I'm counting on you, Arthur, to keep us out of a recession," adding, "I know there's the myth of the autonomous Fed." Burns served as Fed chair for 8 years through to 1978, during which time inflation exploded and didn't fully come down until the early 1980s. Many observers consider him to be one of the least successful chairs in the Fed's history. Now, it barely needs to be said that the US is unlike any other country. Its economy and capital markets dwarf all others. The dollar is the world's reserve currency, and its rates and bond markets are the benchmark for global borrowing costs. That means that the magnitude of any market or economic impact from Trump's political interference is hard to quantify. But America's global heft also means that the worldwide impact of those moves could be much greater. But more broadly, we should be questioning the fundamental assumptions which underpin the role and function of central banking. I believe that while central banks have historically played some stabilizing roles, their modern incarnation is increasingly criticized for undermining market discipline, lacking democratic legitimacy and real accountability. They are fueling inequality and inflation, and are clearly vulnerable to political manipulation. much of the academic analysis of the effectiveness of central banks has been written by central bankers or other neoliberal economists. So there are alternatives which might be considered. These include banks issuing their own currency and operating without a central authority, or currency being backed by a physical commodity like gold and silver, or a monetary authority that pegs the local currency to a foreign one, for example, the US dollar, maintaining full reserves, or algorithmic monetary systems rules-based thinking around blockchain, possibly with a just money supply algorithmically. Or perhaps you could even outsource monetary policy to private institutions or decentralized networks. Now, let me know if you'd like me to delve deeper into these alternative models, all of which have both some advantages and many disadvantages. While removing central banks would be radical and risky, for critics, it's a necessary step towards restoring monetary integrity, decentralizing power, and reasserting democratic control over economic policy. Now, this is an area that needs further exploration, and the tacit assumption that we have at the moment that central banks are good and that we should control them is, of course, one that needs to be questioned. I still believe that central banks, in the large, are part of the problem, not part of the solution. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.